You're a member of the Democratic opposition. They call it the Underground. I don't remember your name, but I do the face. You got out only recently, and wouldn't have if you were more important. Beta shrugged. You know a lot. I do. You escaped with a man. That one? Does it matter what I say? No. I merely want a thorough mutual understanding. I believe that the password during the week you left so hastily was Selden, Hardin, and Freedom. Porphyrat Hart was your section leader. Where'd you get that? Beta was suddenly fierce. Did the police get him? Taran held her back, but she shook herself loose and advanced. The man from the Foundation said quietly, Nobody has him. It's just that the Underground spreads widely and in queer places. I'm Captain Han Pritcher of Information, and I'm a section leader myself, never mind under what name. He waited, then said, No, you don't have to believe me. In our business, it is better to overdo suspicion than the opposite. But I'd better get past the preliminaries. Yes, said Taran. Suppose you do. May I sit down? Thanks. Captain Pritcher swung a long leg across his knee and let an arm swing loose over the back of the chair. I'll start out by saying that I don't know what all this is about, from your angle. You two aren't from the Foundation, but it's not a hard guess that you're from one of the independent trading worlds. That doesn't bother me over much. But out of curiosity, what do you want with that fellow, that clown you snatched to safety? You're risking your life to hold on to him. I can't tell you that. Well, I didn't think you would. But if you're waiting for the mule himself to come behind a fanfare of horns, drums, and electric organs, relax. The mule doesn't work that way. What? It came from both Taran and Beta, and in the corner, where Magnifico lurked with ears almost visibly expanded, there was a sudden joyful start. That's right. I've been trying to contact him myself, and doing a rather more thorough job of it than you two amateurs can. It won't work. The man makes no personal appearances, does not allow himself to be photographed or simulated, and is seen only by his most intimate associates. Is that supposed to explain your interest in us, Captain? Questioned Taran. No. That clown is the key. That clown is one of the very few that have seen him. I want him. He may be the proof I need, and I need something. Galaxy knows, to awaken the Foundation. It needs awakening, broke in Beta with sudden sharpness. Against what? And in what role do you act as alarm? That of rebel Democrat, or of secret police and provocateur? The captain's face set in its hard lines. When the entire Foundation is threatened, Madame Revolutionary, both Democrats and tyrants perish. Let us save the tyrants from a greater, that we may overthrow them in their turn. Who's the greater tyrant you speak of? Flared Beta. The mule. I know a bit about him, enough to have been my death several times over already, if I had moved less nimbly. Send the clown out of the room. This will require privacy. Magnifico, said Beta, with a gesture, and the clown left without a sound. The captain's voice was grave and intense, and low enough so that Taran and Beta drew close. He said, The mule is a shrewd operator, far too shrewd not to realize the advantage of the magnetism and glamour of personal leadership. If he gives that up, it's for a reason. That reason must be the fact that personal contact would reveal something that is of overwhelming importance not to reveal. He waved aside questions and continued more quickly. I went back to his birthplace for this and questioned people who for their knowledge will not live long. Few enough are still alive. They remember the baby born 30 years before, the death of his mother, his strange youth. The mule is not a human being. And his two listeners drew back in horror at the misty implications. Neither understood, fully or clearly, but the menace of the phrase was definite. The captain continued. He is a mutant, and obviously from his subsequent career, a highly successful one. I don't know his powers, or the exact extent to which he is what our thrillers would call a Superman. But the rise from nothing to the conqueror of Kalgan's warlord in 2 years is revealing. You see, don't you, the danger? Can a genetic accident of unpredictable biological properties be taken into account in the Selden plan? Slowly, Beta spoke. I don't believe it. This is some sort of complicated trickery. Why didn't the mule's men kill us when they could have, if he's a Superman? I told you that I don't know the extent of his mutation. He may not be ready yet for the Foundation, and it would be a sign of the greatest wisdom to resist provocation until ready. Suppose you let me speak to the clown. The captain faced the trembling Magnifico, who obviously distrusted this huge, hard man who faced him. The captain began slowly. Have you seen the mule with your own eyes? I have but too well, respected sir, and felt the weight of his arm with my own body as well. I have no doubt of that. Can you describe him? It is frightening to recall him, respected sir. He is a man of mighty frame. Against him, even you would be but a spindling. His hair is of a burning crimson, and with all my strength and weight, I could not pull down his arm once extended, not a hair's thickness. Magnifico's thinness seemed to collapse upon itself in a huddle of arms and legs. Often, to amuse his generals or to amuse only himself, he would suspend me by one finger in my belt from a fearful height while I chattered poetry. It was only after the 20th verse that I was withdrawn, and each improvised and each a perfect rhyme, or else start over. He is a man of overpowering might, respected sir, and cruel in the use of his power. And his eyes, respected sir, no one sees. What? What's that last? He wears spectacles, respected sir, of a curious nature. It is said that they are opaque, and that he sees by a powerful magic that far transcends human powers. I have heard, and his voice was small and mysterious, that to see his eyes is to see death, that he kills with his eyes, respected sir. Magnifico's eyes wheeled quickly from one watching face to another. He quavered, "It is true. As I live, it is true." Beta drew a long breath. "Sounds like you're right, Captain. Do you want to take over?" "Well, let's look at the situation. You don't owe anything here. The hangar's barrier above is free. I can leave any time." "Then leave. The mule may not wish to antagonize the Foundation, but he runs a frightful risk in letting Magnifico get away. It probably accounts for the hue and cry after the poor devil in the first place. So there may be ships waiting for you upstairs. If you're lost in space, who's to pin the crime?" "You're right," agreed Toran bleakly. "However, you've got a shield, and you're probably speedier than anything they've got. So as soon as you're clear of the atmosphere, make the circle in neutral to the other hemisphere. Then just cut a track outwards at top acceleration." "Yes," said Beta coldly. "And when we are back on the Foundation, what then, Captain?" "Why, you are then cooperative citizens of Kalgan, are you not? I know nothing to the contrary, do I?" Nothing was said. Toran turned to the controls. There was an imperceptible lurch. It was when Toran had left Kalgan sufficiently far in the rear to attempt his first interstellar jump that Captain Pritchard's face first creased slightly, for no ship of the Mule had in any way attempted to bar their leaving. "Looks like he's letting us carry off Magnifico," said Toran. "Not so good for your story." "Unless," corrected the captain, "he wants us to carry him off, in which case it's not so good for the Foundation." It was after the last jump, when within neutral flight distance of the Foundation, that the first ultra-wave news broadcast reached the ship. And there was one news item barely mentioned. It seemed that a warlord, unidentified by the board speaker, had made representations to the Foundation concerning the forceful abduction of a member of his court. The announcer went on to the sports news. Captain Pritchard said icily, "He's one step ahead of us after all." Thoughtfully, he added, "He's ready for the Foundation, and he uses this as an excuse for action. It makes things more difficult for us. We will have to act before we are really ready." Chapter 15. The Psychologist. There was reason to the fact that the element known as pure science was the freest form of life on the Foundation. In a galaxy where the predominance and even survival of the Foundation still rested upon the superiority of its technology, even despite its large access of physical power in the last century and a half, a certain immunity adhered to the scientist. He was needed, and he knew it. Likewise, there was reason to the fact that Ebling Miz, only those who did not know him added his titles to his name, was the freest form of life in the pure science of the Foundation. In a world where science was respected, he was the scientist, with capital letters and no smile. He was needed, and he knew it. And so it happened that when others bent their knee, he refused and added loudly that his ancestors in their time bowed no knee to any stinking mayor. And in his ancestors' time, the mayor was elected anyhow and kicked out at will, and that the only people that inherited anything by right of birth were the congenital idiots. So it also happened that when Ebling Miz decided to allow Inber to honor him with an audience, he did not wait for the usual rigid line of command to pass his request up and the favored reply down. But having thrown the less disreputable of his two formal jackets over his shoulders, and pounded an odd hat of impossible design on one side of his head, and lit a forbidden cigar into the bargain, he barged past two ineffectually bleeding guards and into the mayor's palace. The first notice His Excellence received of the intrusion was when from his garden he heard the gradually nearing uproar of expostulation and the answering bull roar of inarticulate swearing. Slowly, Inber lay down his trowel. Slowly, he stood up. And slowly, he frowned. For Inber allowed himself a daily vacation from work, and for 2 hours in the early afternoon, weather permitting, he was in his garden. There in his garden, the blooms grew in squares and triangles, interlaced in a severe order of red and yellow, with little dashes of violet at the apices, and greenery bordering the whole in rigid lines. There in his garden, no one disturbed him. No one. Inber peeled off his soil-stained gloves as he advanced toward the little garden door. Inevitably, he said, "What is the meaning of this?" It is the precise question and the precise wording thereof that has been put to the atmosphere on such occasions by an incredible variety of men since humanity was invented. It is not recorded that it has ever been asked for any purpose other than dignified effect. But the answer was literal this time, for Miz's body came plunging through with a bellow and a shake of a fist at the ones who were still holding tatters of his cloak. Inber motioned them away with a solemn, displeased frown, and Miz bent to pick up his ruin of a hat, shake about a quarter of the gathered dirt off it, thrust it under his armpit, and say, "Look here, Inber, those unprintable minions of yours will be charged for one good cloak. Lots of good wear left in this cloak." He puffed and wiped his forehead with just a trace of theatricality. The mayor stood stiff with displeasure and said haughtily from the peak of his 5'2", "It has not been brought to my attention, Miz, that you have requested an audience. You have certainly not been assigned one." Ebling Miz looked down at his mayor with what was apparently shocked disbelief. "Galaxy, Inber! Didn't you get my note yesterday? I handed it to a flunky in purple uniform day before. I would have handed it to you direct, but I know how you like formality." "Formality?" Inber turned up exasperated eyes. Then strenuously, "Have you ever heard of proper organization? At all future times, you are to submit your request for an audience, properly made out in triplicate, at the government office intended for the purpose. You are then to wait until the ordinary course of events brings you notification of the time of audience to be granted. You are then to appear properly clothed, do you understand? And with proper respect, too. You may leave." "What's wrong with my clothes?" demanded Miz hotly. "Best cloak I had till those unprintable fiends got their claws on it. I'll leave just as soon as I deliver what I have come to deliver. Galaxy! If it didn't involve a Selden crisis, I would leave right now." "Selden crisis?" Inber exhibited first interest. Miz was a great psychologist, a Democrat, boor, and rebel, certainly, but a psychologist, too. In his uncertainty, the mayor even failed to put into words the inner pang that stabbed suddenly when Miz plucked a casual bloom, held it to his nostrils expectantly, then flipped it away with a wrinkled nose. Inber said coldly, "Would you follow me? This garden wasn't made for serious conversation." He felt better in his built-up chair behind his large desk, from which he could look down on the few hairs that quite ineffectually hid Miz's pink scalp skin. He felt much better when Miz cast a series of automatic glances about him for a non-existent chair, and then remained standing in uneasy shifting fashion. He felt best of all when, in response to a careful pressure of the correct contact, a liveried underling scurried in, bowed his way to the desk, and laid thereon a bulky, metal-bound volume. "Now, in order," said Inber, once more master of the situation, "to make this unauthorized interview as short as possible, make your statement in the fewest possible words." Ebling Miz said unhurriedly, "You know what I'm doing these days?" "I have your reports here," replied the mayor with satisfaction, "together with authorized summaries of them. As I understand it, your investigations into the mathematics of psychohistory have been intended to duplicate Harry Seldon's work and eventually trace the projected course of future history for the use of the Foundation."
"Exactly," said Miz dryly. "When Seldon first established the Foundation, he was wise enough to include no psychologists among the scientists placed here, so that the Foundation has always worked blindly along the course of historical necessity. In the course of my researches, I have based a good deal upon hints found at the Time Vault."
"I am aware of that, Miz. It is a waste of time to repeat."
"I'm not repeating," blared Miz, "because what I'm going to tell you isn't in any of those reports."
"How do you mean, not in the reports?" said Inber stupidly.
"How could..." "Galaxy! Let me tell this my own way, you offensive little creature! Stop putting words into my mouth and questioning my every statement, or I'll tramp out of here and let everything crumble around you. Remember, you unprintable fool, the Foundation will come through because it must. But if I walk out of here now, you won't."
Dashing his hat on the floor so that clouds of earth scattered, he sprang up the stairs of the dais on which the wide desk stood, and shoving papers violently, sat down upon a corner of it. Inber thought frantically of summoning the guard, or using the built-in blasters of his desk. But Miz's face was glaring down upon him, and there was nothing to do but cringe the best face upon it. "Dr. Miz," he began with weak formality.
"You must..." "Shut up," said Miz ferociously, "and listen. If this thing here," and his palm came down heavily on the metal of the bound data, "is a mess of my reports, throw it out. Any report I write goes up through some 20-odd officials, gets to you, and then sort of winds down through 20 more. That's fine if there's nothing you don't want kept secret. Well, I've got something confidential here. It's so confidential, even the boys working for me haven't got wind of it. They did the work, of course, but each just a little unconnected piece, and I put it together. You know what the Time Vault is?"
Inver nodded his head, but Miz went on with loud enjoyment of the situation.
"Well, I'll tell you anyhow, because I've been sort of imagining this unprintable situation for a galaxy of a long time. I can read your mind, you puny fraud. You've got your hand right near a little knob that'll call in about 500 or so armed men to finish me off. But you're afraid of what I know. You're afraid of a Seldon crisis. Besides which, if you touch anything on your desk, I'll knock your unprintable head off before anyone gets here. You and your bandit father and pirate grandfather have been blood-sucking the Foundation long enough anyway."
This is treason," gabbled Inber.
"It certainly is," gloated Miz. "But what are you going to do about it? Now let me tell you about the Time Vault. That Time Vault is what Harry Seldon placed here at the beginning to help us over the rough spots. For every crisis, Seldon has prepared a personal simulacrum to help and explain. 4 crises so far, 4 appearances. The first time he appeared at the height of the first crisis. The second time, he appeared at a moment just after the successful evolution of the second crisis. Our ancestors were there to listen to him both times. At the third and fourth crises, he was ignored, probably because he was not needed. But recent investigations, not included in those reports you have, indicate that he appeared anyway and at the proper times. Get it?"
He did not wait for any answer. His cigar, a tattered, dead ruin, was finally disposed of. A new cigar groped for and lit. The smoke puffed out violently. He said,
"Officially, I've been trying to rebuild the science of psychohistory. Well, no one man is going to do that, and it won't get done in any one century either. But I've made advances in the more simple elements, and I've been able to use it as an excuse to meddle with the Time Vault. What I have done involves the determination, to a pretty fair kind of certainty, of the exact date of the next appearance of Harry Seldon. I can give you the exact day, in other words, that the coming Seldon crisis, the fifth, will reach its climax.
How far off? Demanded Inber tensely. And Miz exploded his bomb with cheerful nonchalance.
4 months, he said. 4 unprintable months, less 2 days.
4 months, said Inber, with uncharacteristic vehemence.
Impossible! Impossible, my unprintable eye!
4 months! Do you understand what that means? For a crisis to come to a head in 4 months would mean that it has been preparing for years.
And why not? Is there a law of nature that requires the process to mature in the full light of day?
But nothing impends. Nothing hangs over us. Inver almost wrung his hands for anxiety. With a sudden spasmodic recrudescence of ferocity, he screamed,
Will you get off my desk and let me put it in order? How do you expect me to think?
Miz, startled, lifted heavily and moved aside. Inver replaced objects in their appropriate niches with a feverish motion. He was speaking quickly.
You have no right to come here like this. If you had presented your theory...
It is not a theory.
I say it is a theory. If you had presented it together with your evidence and arguments in appropriate fashion, it would have gone to the Bureau of Historical Sciences. There it could have been properly treated, the resulting analyses submitted to me, and then, of course, proper action would have to be taken. As it is, you vexed me to no purpose. Ah, here it is.
He had a sheet of transparent silvery paper in his hand, which he shook at the bulbous psychologist beside him.
This is a short summary I prepare myself, weekly, of foreign matters in progress.
Listen. We have completed negotiations for a commercial treaty with Mores. Continue negotiations for one with Lyoness. Sent a delegation to some celebration or other on Bande. Received some complaint or other from Calgan, and we've promised to look into it. Protested some sharp trade practices in Asperta, and they've promised to look into it. And so on, and so on. The mayor's eyes swarmed down the list of coded notations, and then he carefully placed the sheet in its proper place in the proper folder, in the proper pigeonhole.
I tell you, Miz, there's not a thing there that breaches anything but order and peace.
The door at the far long end opened, and in far too dramatically coincident a fashion to suggest anything but real life, a plainly costumed notable stepped in. Inver half rose. He had the curiously swirling sensation of unreality that comes upon those days when too much happens. After Mrs. intrusion and wild fumings, there now came the equally improper, hence disturbing, intrusion unannounced of his secretary, who at least knew the rules. The secretary kneeled low. Inver said sharply,
Well?
The secretary addressed the floor. Excellence, a Captain Han Pritcher of information, returning from Calgan in disobedience to your orders, has, according to prior instructions, your order X-20-513 has been imprisoned and awaits execution. Those accompanying him are being held for questioning. A full report has been filed.
Inver, in agony, said, A full report has been received.
Well? Excellence, Captain Pritcher has reported vaguely dangerous designs on the part of the new warlord of Calgan. He has been given, according to prior instructions, your order X-20-651, no formal hearing, but his remarks have been recorded and a full report filed.
Inver screamed, A full report has been received! Well?
Excellence, reports have within the quarter hour been received from the Selinian frontier. Ships identified as Calganian have been entering Foundation territory, unauthorized. The ships are armed. Fighting has occurred. The secretary was bent nearly double. Inber remained standing. Ebling Miz shook himself, clumped up to the secretary, and tapped him sharply on the shoulder.
Here, you'd better have them release this Captain Pritcher, and have him sent here. Get out.
The secretary left, and Miz turned to the mayor.
Hadn't you better get the machinery moving, Inber? 4 months, you know.
Inber remained standing, glaze-eyed. Only one finger seemed alive, and it traced rapid, jerky triangles on the smooth desktop before him. Chapter 16, Conference. When the 27 independent trading worlds, united only by their distrust of the mother planet of the Foundation, concert an assembly among themselves, and each is big with a pride grown of its smallness, hardened by its own insularity, and embittered by eternal danger, there are preliminary negotiations to be overcome of a pettiness sufficiently staggering to heart-sicken the most persevering. It is not enough to fix in advance such details as methods of voting, type of representation, whether by world or by population. These are matters of involved political importance. It is not enough to fix matters of priority at the table, both council and dinner. Those are matters of involved social importance. It was the place of meeting, since that was a matter of overpowering provincialism. And in the end, the devious roots of diplomacy led to the world of Radol, which some commentators had suggested at the start for logical reason of central position. Radol was a small world, and in military potential, perhaps the weakest of the 27. That, by the way, was another factor in the logic of the choice. It was a ribbon world, of which the galaxy boasts sufficient, but among which the inhabited variety is a rarity. It was a world, in other words, where the two halves face the monotonous extremes of heat and cold, while the region of possible life is the birdling ribbon of the twilight zone. Such a world invariably sounds uninviting to those who have not tried it, but there exist spots strategically placed, and Radol City was located in such a one. It spread along the soft slopes of the foothills before the hacked-out mountains that backed it along the rim of the cold hemisphere and held off the frightful ice. The warm, dry air of the sun half spilled over, and from the mountains was piped the water, and between the two, Radol City became a continuous garden, swimming in the eternal morning of an eternal June. Each house nestled among its flower garden, open to the fangless elements. Each garden was a horticultural forcing ground, where luxury plants grew in fantastic patterns for the sake of the foreign exchange they brought, until Radol had almost become a producing world, rather than a typical trading world. So in its way, Radol City was a little point of softness and luxury on a horrible planet, a tiny scrap of Eden, and that too was a factor in the logic of the choice. The strangers came from each of the 26 other trading worlds. Delegates, wives, secretaries, newsmen, ships, and crews. And Radol's population nearly doubled, and Radol's resources strained themselves to the limit. One ate at will, and drank at will, and slept not at all. Yet there were few among the roisterers who were not intensely aware that all that volume of the galaxy burnt slowly in a sort of quiet, slumberous war. And of those who were aware, there were three classes. First, there were the many who knew little and were very confident, such as the young space pilot who wore the Haven cockade on the clasp of his cap, and who managed, in holding his glass before his eyes, to catch those of the faintly smiling Radolian girl opposite. He was saying, "We came right through the war zone to get here, on purpose. We traveled about a light minute or so in neutral, right past Horliger." "Horliger," broke in a long-legged native who was playing host to that particular gathering. "That's where the mule got the guts beat out of him last week, wasn't it?" "Where'd you hear that the mule got the guts beat out of him?" demanded the pilot loftily. "Foundation radio." "Yeah? Well, the mule's got Horliger. We almost ran into a convoy of his ships, and that's where they were coming from. It isn't a gut beating when you stay where you fought, and the gut beater leaves in a hurry." Someone else said in a high, blurred voice, "Don't talk like that. Foundation always takes it on the chin for a while. You wash. Just sit tight and wash. Old Foundation knows when to come back." And then, pow! The thick voice concluded and was succeeded by a bleary grin. "Anyway," said the pilot from Haven after a short pause, "as I say, we saw the mule ships. And they looked pretty good, pretty good. I'll tell you what, they looked new." "New," said the native thoughtfully. "They build them themselves?" He broke a leaf from an overhanging branch, sniffed delicately at it, then crunched it between his teeth, the bruised tissues bleeding greenly and diffusing a minty odor. He said, "You trying to tell me they beat foundation ships with home-built jobs?" This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.